Just a quick note, this is a two-part podcast. Part two of this podcast will be on the Patreon feed.
I learned a lot since I last saw you. I learned that death is not the end. I can help you, help you, help you, help you.
Welcome back, listeners. Another episode of Escape from Planet for you. I'm your host for tonight, Chris, here with Teen, Liza, and Jess. What's up?
Yay!
Hey, hey, hey.
Happy New Year, everyone.
It hasn't been the four of us in a long time. In fact, it's,
I feel
it's
like
really
I'm
not,
in back in 2018.
Ever. It's just that I haven't
been
talked
that
to Liza in a while.
Like, no, I talk to you every weeks. Day in like Discord.
In Discord, but in like on a pod and stuff. It's been a
while. With an audience, yeah.
At least several weeks.
Several weeks, but maybe months.
Almost
months.
I
think months. Yeah. I
well,
think,
we did that. We did that one, but I don't think it got released.
Oh, wait, with Karthik. Yeah, we. I still have that. I still have that one. Yeah. I'll put that together.
All right. Well, I'm so glad four of us are together. As I said, it feels like old times. Back in like 2017/2018.
OG
I'm still
crew.
Living in that dingy little studio, my little Go mic, talking to my bookshelf, and we were all too much on Twitter and caring too much about what certain people whom we should not care about thought. But new year, new era, and we're together for a new purpose. And if listeners, if you are Patreon subscribers and you listen to the latest bonus episodes, Tina and me, and we alluded to this episode that we'd wanted to do that focused on... Well, we would start talking about our love for certain oldish technologies like film cameras and typewriters and what it really speaks to a broader, the things we lose when everything is too digitized. So that's the topic we want to get to today.
I think of it as like a movement. I really do.
There should be a movement.
There's a larger, there's definitely a larger
there's
movement.
There's huge
yeah.
things at play here and they're all converging at different times and like over the course of like probably decades that have led
Maybe
to
I'm
this.
Getting a little bit ahead of myself, but like I'll say like the last couple of days I spent, so I got this new typewriter, this Olympia SM4, a beautiful typewriter. It's probably from the late 50s. It's working great. There's a slight hitch to it in that the carriage hits the case when you return it. Teen, I don't know if your typewriter had any issues out of the box, but apparently this is a common problem with this typewriter. So the last few days I've been online trying to search how to repair it. I tried one method, it didn't work. So it's like I'm trying to solve a problem, and I'm going to the hardware store. I'm buying these like little knickknacks, like these rubber
Did you
stoppers.
Buy it from eBay or from like
I bought it from eBay, yeah.
Okay.
And I think the process of trying to solve a problem, even a very small problem, like I have this very minor little defect on my old typewriter, is something that if you grew up in a world where everything is streamlined for you, everything is done for you, you have no idea how anything works because everything's just given to you. And then something goes wrong, you just become very helpless. Have you guys ever seen have you seen the season 2 of The White Lotus? I just finished seeing it.
I only watched season 1 and I was so disappointed I could not continue to season 2.
Okay. I just bring it up because there's a character there who's supposed to be like in her mid-20s, supposed to be like a Zoomer, and she's just so helpless. She's just like very whiny and can't do anything. And I think a problem with that is, and I'm not exempting our generation from it, but if you don't actually ever get to solve problems, especially little problems, and realize you can actually fix things, you just give up very easily. But anyway, I think
well,
I'm getting ahead of myself.
It's it's funny. I was kind of laughing a little when you were saying that because like today, literally, I went to the Google store. There is such a thing as a Google store now. And
what do they sell?
Gross.
Google stuff like, yeah, Pixel.
Wait, phones. What?
Yeah, it's like an Apple store, but it's a Google store.
You just mean the one in Chelsea?
I went to the one in Williamsburg. But I went there because like my wife's phone, her Pixel phone, the USB-C port doesn't quite work. How it's supposed to be bi-directional? Or it doesn't matter which way you plug it in. But for some reason, her phone, it matters which way you plug it in. And so I just went there to be like, well, it's still under warranty. And I said, it's not a big deal. But, the USB-C thing, it's supposed to work either way. It doesn't work. It only works one way. And so I figured, maybe I'd see if I can get it fixed. And the very nice lady, she was like, we'll probably just have to, get you a new phone. She was like, the USB thing is attached to the motherboard, so I don't think that can be fixed. I was like, okay, we'll take a new phone.
That is such a huge problem for everything. It's like all these features that we never asked for and don't want. And so when one little tiny thing goes, the whole thing goes with it. It's like cars.
Yeah.
It's like, remember back when everyone was able to just change their own oil? And like, you can't do that anymore.
Yeah. Or when, like, you know, when you saw dudes hanging out in their front in the you know, on a Sunday or a Saturday, they're you know, in your neighborhood, like, people would fix their cars, but nobody does that anymore. Yeah.
I mean, you guys have heard of Right to Repair, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wait, what's that?
So it's a budding kind of like philosophical slash legal movement. It's basically trying to claw back. It's basically a challenge to the concept of what ownership means these days.
Mm-hmm.
Like when we talk about buying a phone or buying a car or something, if you really unpack it, you don't really get to own the thing, right? Because of exactly all the things that you're talking about, right? Like if a single thing breaks, it's not easy to fix. You're still beholden probably back to the manufacturer or some licensed subsidiary for that repair. They get to milk money out of it. You often void your entire warranty if you try to do it yourself. And a lot of the especially if it's something like an IoT thing, an Internet of Things thing or whatever, like, you are dependent on their mercy for like updates, right? If an update happens to brick your shit or whatever, you're at their mercy. So in that sense, like, in what it is, it truly ownership or did we repackage like a rentier economy? Right.
Jess said something important there. She called it a movement. So there's like little movements within the larger movement.
Mm-hmm. Like a landmark case that I think is still percolating through the courts, but it still was a win for this Right to Repair movement is a case brought against John Deere, the big agriculture, like giant like combines and tractors and farm equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they pretty much have a monopoly on farm equipment in some sectors. And if something, and they have a really predatory pipeline for servicing these tractors. So you buy it. So you pay a huge amount of money up front to buy this thing. But if something breaks, you have to call a John Deere technician to come service it for you. You are dependent on their software. You are not allowed to tinker with any of that on your own. I think they can like void your warranty, and I think they can go a little further than that too to actually take some kind of like punitive action if you do try to.
Like, and those combines and tractors have to be like what's the price range for those? They're huge.
I don't know, but well, it's a significant amount of money. Like maybe the scale is a little different because we are talking like big, large scale agriculture here. But like this can impact like small farmers too. So regardless of the price, like they have an extremely predatory extraction model for like maintaining and servicing this equipment. So the challenge was brought, like, in what sense have we actually bought this shit, right? We don't have the right to repair this despite the contract saying that we own this. So it's something that I don't think a lot of people, we were kind of encouraged to not think about that. It's a problem that isn't even like, we're misdirected, right?
Phones now come like they're dipped in molten glass and the whole thing's like completely hermetically sealed. And if any part of it goes wrong, you know, you've got to get a new one. And,
it's funny because like
Chris told me that he took his MacBook to Rossmann Group, and Louis Rossmann is like that, you know, he's a big Right to Repair name, right? Like he's big on Right to Repair. So Louis Rossmann rants about this all the time about how Apple's business model exists basically to screw the customer because, you know, anytime anything goes wrong, they set their repair, but like you have to go to Apple to get it fixed. Because no one else is going to be able to, very few shops are going to be able to do it. And the amount that they're going to quote is so high that oftentimes what they tell you is like, you know, it's better to just get a new one, which is
really that's what that fucker at the Apple store told me.
Yeah.
He said it was my fault for not taking care of my laptop, which is only like 3 or 4 years old. And I take really good care of myself. Okay. So Rossmann Group, they basically, my H key malfunction, and Apple Store told me it would cost me $500 to fix it. Rossmann Group did it for free because I was fixing my battery, so they were giving me a new battery, and they just threw in that for free. So fuck Apple. I'm glad they got that class action lawsuit. They lost it, even though it's like pennies to them. It was only $50 million, which is nothing. But
something else I've been noticing is, when I'm thinking like big picture, is that the villain in like most big blockbuster movies, like if you're watching Jurassic World or like Glass Onion or anything like that, the villain, or like Don't Look Up, for example, the villain is like, it's Steve Jobs, right? It's like a Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, like Mark Zuckerberg. It's a tech guy, right? That's who the villains are. It's always the little guy versus the big tech guy who has an obsession with like innovation, and he sees himself as some sort of like creative guru, and he's obsessed with spying on all of us all the time, you know? It's like the same guy over and over again.
I think that's right. But the thing is, and maybe we can segue a little bit into, you know, sort of our own personal interests in sort of de-digitizing, which I think is, like you said, a movement. Although I don't know if it's called that or anything, but it's like you said, it's a lot of different movements but I think they're all kind of pointing in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, you know, honestly, at the end of the day, I think we have to blame ourselves because, you know, you just see, I mean, I saw people like camping out to buy the next version of the iPhone, you know, or people, you know, just like complaining about social media on social media, right? Like, we have so overbought, overinvested into digital technologies that
personal brand.
Yeah. I mean, literally just people recentering their entire lives online that I feel like we only have ourselves to blame. And so in a way, we've got to find our own way out. Like, I don't think we can rely on there being, you know, some sort of corporate or government, you know, solution to all this stuff. I think we're just going to have to literally abandon technologies, these smartphone based online technologies to an extent.
A very specific business model. So in this framing, like, I know all the villains are like these tech guys and stuff like that. But if you think about like what the solution is, there can never be a person at the top like that who can fix this particular problem. Which kind of means that a person like that, as evil as he might be, was not the heart and was not the source of the problem to begin with, right? I think a lot of people go a little too far and say, okay, there's something fundamentally evil about the technology, so we kind of basically have to roll it, like we kind of have to be like proto-Luddites. Right, like neo Amish, basically. Right, like there's something just fundamentally evil about the nature of like technology itself. It's kind of interesting because I was like thinking of Tolkien. That was a major part of his work here. Like he was a veteran of World War II. You know, sharpest rollouts of technology. Like
World War One?
Maybe World War One, but anyway, like
I think it's two. I think for Tolkien it was two. No,
okay. Well, one of the World Wars.
One of the World Wars. But basically, he was born before then, of course. So you know, he was part of that extraordinary generation that witnessed basically a 180 shift of modern society, basically well within one generation. Like he watched. He was probably able to watch like horses and carriages slowly disappear from the streets, and then like not even in middle age see like airplanes dropping bombs.
Okay, but where do you
imagine if it's your first time ever seeing an airplane and like you die because of it?
Yeah, that probably happened. Like World War One, like farm boys who grew up like taking care of the horse that pulled the plow. And then getting gunned down with machine guns or like fighter planes, like that's I can see how that's just a that's just a total mind fuck. I'm going a little too far on that.
Let's ground this in a little bit more like personal experiences first, and then branch out. Because I think let's start with the teen you getting the twin lens reflex camera, which you a bunch of us at Planet A, we got you for your wedding, which
thank you, you know, everyone.
It was a great event in the history of 2022. And so I've had a couple of film cameras for several years now. One that I frequently brought out, especially to kind of special events, like when we went to Copaig or, you know, whenever we went camping or stuff, had a Nikon F3 and a Zorki 4. The Nikon I use more because it's in better shape. And, you know, I got it on a whim kind of in like 2016, I think. And, you know, I don't use it often, but, you know, I use it enough. And I noticed that Teen, you really liked it. So I got a bunch of guys together and we're like, hey, let's chip in, and got you this Yashica A, which is, as I said, a twin lens reflex camera. It's like one of those cool cameras with the two, what do you call it?
It's like a double lens. It's like the double barreled shotgun of cameras.
Yeah. It kind of looks like a carnival camera. That's how I was looking at it. When, you know, it looks very cool. And anyway, so Teen, like, why don't you, because you, I think, only really started using it rather recently, right? Like getting it developed and stuff. So yeah, why don't you tell us about your experiences and how it's different, and, you know, it's how it's more than just, hey, instead of like, there's a difference, right? Using that versus a digital camera.
Yeah. First, I'm super late to the film game because I didn't know Liza was big on film photography way back.
Oh, right. Yeah. So wait, Liza, what cameras do you have? I'm just curious.
What does Liza have?
I use a Pentax and an old Canon that my dad gave me.
Wait, a Pentax K1000?
I have a Pentax from the 90s that I got when I was in high school and taking darkroom photography.
Oh, cool.
And then I took darkroom photography in college too. My dad gave me an old Canon that he uses. And when my kids take pictures, I only allow them to use film cameras.
Oh, wow. They're going to be so cool.
When they were young, I started them on disposable cameras and Polaroids. And now they're moving into like 35mm. And if they want to take pictures, it's got to be film. And then they have to understand that, like, you know, you only have like 24 exposures or 27 exposures, 36 exposures.
You got to be really careful and deliberate
when you take the picture. And then, you know, the era of the 1 hour photo is gone. So now you have to wait 2 weeks to see your pictures.
You're the only one then. If you took darkroom photography
When I got married in 2008, we demanded that our wedding photos and our wedding movie be shot on film. So the wedding pictures are on film. And the wedding video is actually 16mm and Super 8.
Wow. If I were a wedding photographer, and I had to show
myself,
I'd be so
nervous.
There's
only one guy in the world that did that, and his name was Zapruder.
Well, now you can... What were you going
to say? But if you took darkroom photography, then you're probably the only one out of us that has, like, developed film and you worked an enlarger and all that stuff, right? Like, you were doing you were doing prints and stuff in the darkroom. And that's really cool. I would like to do that next. That's the thing I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. But to Chris's question, this is a very interesting question because I go online and I do a little research as to like what is fueling this resurgence in film photography. And the reason I know there is a resurgence in film photography is because trying to buy a roll of film it's super pricey right now.
Oh my God.
And the reason is because.
For 8 pictures, it's $20. For that.
Yeah. 35mm standard is about 15 to 20.
You have to be so precious about what you shoot.
Yeah. So it's costly because, well, one, there's not as many labs, but two, that I mean, for the development side, but just acquiring the film, there's just a lot of demand. And so the price has gone up. And I looked online and it's that's true. It's just, there's a resurgence in it. And
cheap at Target. So just keep that in mind.
What's
anyone
that?
Listening.
It's cheaper at Target?
It's Polaroid film and like film is cheap at Target.
Oh,
I didn't know Target sold
cheaper at Target than it is at on Amazon.
Okay,
Target's doing some crazy stuff. Target has this like nail polish, this manicure machine. Like you basically stick your hand in, and you get like a robot will like basically 3D print a manicure onto your hand.
Oh, where
wow.
do they
have it?
It's
only a couple locations, but
it's nowhere
insane.
Near either of us, right?
No, it's still experimental, but it's like that. Something's going on at Target HQ. They're really.
Oh, the Vietnamese nail salon people are going to be against.
Oh no!
That.
Oh no!
ChatGPT for the nail industry.
The nail salons.
We're gonna have to go jihad on that nail machine.
Yeah,
but I think that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people talk about how film force because of the cost and whatever the you know the limited number of shots that it forces you to think more about it. Okay. But I think the difference, it really has to do with digital, meaning like there's something about digital images and digital anything that eliminates the concept of an original.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you digitize something, the concept of an original is gone. There is no master image. It's just like if you record in digital, like we don't, like all these podcasts that we do, there's no original. There's no original recording. And
there's no plan A masters in a vault somewhere.
Yeah, there's no masters in a vault. And, you know, and I sent around that article. I don't know if you all had a chance to read it, which I thought was a brilliant article because it does go into this, which is that there is something about the existence of a master. And when you're dealing with film, there is a master negative. Mm-hmm. And as that article said about these tapes, these master recordings of musicians, that is it. That's the, you know, as good as you can get in terms of fidelity is that original. And as good an image as you can get is that negative. You can never do better than that. Mm-hmm. Image. But that's the information side of this. That's like the quality of the image. That's an issue of quality. That's an issue of fidelity. But I think there's like a sort of like almost like not spiritual, but like there's a feeling involved in knowing that there's an original, because it you're creating something one of a kind. And I think that just gets lost with digital in a way that no matter how many pictures you take, no matter how great the images are, you don't have that treasure of an original artifact. And I think that's something that's missing, which is why people are kind of going back. That's what I think is driving it. You know,
it's a fundamental kind of like physical right alienation. And you can tell like exactly, and I can tell the truth of what you're saying, because that was entirely at the heart of NFT mania. There was a fundamental like
that's true.
Contradiction,
that's a good point.
Yeah, in that, because they were trying to
what NFTs were trying to address. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah, and aside, I'm not here to bag on NFTs or that whole bubble. I'm simply like responding to what it was stirring up in people. And you're right. They are seeking that one of a kind, some grounding point, some foundation point. That like this is the origin point for this piece of work, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And then anything past this point is a replica.
It's a copy.
Right? The same
way that
a Picasso at auction will sell for like $1 billion, but you can buy a print for like $2 on Amazon or something.
Yeah.
Like that is the ground zero for this work. People were seeking that, but the problem was that they were seeking to do that on a thing that is infinitely replicable at the same fidelity. Like whatever happened, like any reproduction of like a Picasso, a Rembrandt or something is a reduction in quality from that original. It's never going to be 100% true to the original.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's that tiny little delta that makes such a huge difference. What they were trying to do is a thing like digital art, endlessly replicable at the same fidelity an infinite number of times. Mm-hmm. And somehow trying to still create that sense of art or value. So it speaks to the human need, right? The need to have some kind of grounding in something. And to go back to like all the way back to when you're talking about, you know, like going to the store to fix this phone, and they're saying, well, it's kind of like it's in a way it's kind of saying this phone is endlessly replicable too. And that's what happened. Like these commodities are so cheap that it's actually still more worth it to Google to chuck the phone that you brought in and just give you a brand new one. Functionally infinite from the perspective of the end user. So it is creating a bit of an alienation. I remember like loving the phones that I bought, loving my devices. Because there's a sense that this, you know, there might be, you know, that there's that what is that? Is that a saying at this point or whatever? Like, there are many like it, but this one is mine. You know, like there was still that sense. Yeah. Now it's like everybody has the same thing. It's functionally infinite. This right to repair thing implies that like there is no interiority to this device for me at this point. Like, I'm in trouble if I try to seek it out or try to make it my own past what I am allowed based on the contract that I've signed with this device or service provider. So it's basically cutting any human component out of this relationship that we all depend on for a big portion of our lives now.
Yeah. To push back
it's a bit very alienating
on
feeling. Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, to push back a little bit on what you guys said, I will say when I do develop my film photos, I used to get them printed until I realized that I didn't have a scanner at the time. I have a scanner now. But, it's just easier to just get them scanned. So I just developed them and scanned them. So there's actually no physical copy. So while you guys were saying that, I was thinking, like, are we really thinking about, is there a master copy that is the most pristine and unadulterated form? And every time we share it with someone, is it being degraded and it's devalued in that way? I think that it might be true on a subliminal level, but I also think it's true that whenever I take film photos of people, they really love it. And it's different. Like, it's not even about the quality of a shot. Because I think if I took just my phone, I took this like beautifully lit picture of someone, they would like it, but it'd be like, okay, that's cool. And then they probably would never think about it. But then if I tell them, hey, remember that night I brought my camera, I took this picture of you, and I sent it to them, it kind of like, I can just see their faces light up. And why is that? Is it because it was like, okay, I only have like 24 shots or like 36 shots of this, and I decided to spend this one on you. And
people so rarely see themselves in the printed form now. We're so used to seeing people are, it's so rare. It's such a novelty now to print your pictures. And to like.
But I'm saying, I'm not printing these pictures. I'm sending them by email because I don't have the printed pictures myself. It's all scanned. But the way I shot it was, as I said, it's not just on my phone where it's just like.
There's a human warmth in it that's in.
Right. It's like, I got like 10 gigabytes worth of space.
Like a cell phone picture.
Well, right. I think it's fine. Well, I think it's fine that you're digitizing them and then sending them as digital files. But what I'm saying is, and I do think it is subliminal, you're right. But the point is that people understand more or less how a camera works. And they understand that at the moment you took that picture of me, there was like a physical process that happened that created the negative.
Yeah, and there was some kind of sacrifice that you made, being that you had like 36 exposures that you paid money for that you will have to go and get developed, and you decide to spend that on me as opposed to this endlessly erasable, reformatable, whatever hard drive that you have on your phone or your digital camera. You actually, there was like a cost to it, and you paid it to me. And I think that's what people are really appreciating.
Yeah, but I think that I think there's that, but what I'm trying to say about the there being a master image is because it's the film, there is an understanding, I think, a subliminal understanding that when you take a film photo of someone, that there is a piece of film out there with them on it, and that is it. And it's something that happened that's unique. And even if you scan it, it's not the image itself. It is just a copy of that negative. And that negative, and this is, I think, that this is what the that article about the master tapes was getting into. Because remember, so there was this big fire at Universal Studios in Hollywood that destroyed like 200,000, master recordings of, everyone from like Chuck Berry to Louis Armstrong to, shit. I mean, just insane loss.
Wait, when was this?
2008?
2008.
Oh, damn. Yeah.
And they try to bury the story. So Universal was
like masters for the Beatles, Elvis, like the biggest names. This was just some miscellaneous fire. This is like the
American
culture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Lost, and the originals are just gone.
And so there was a great investigative report in the New York Times about it not that long ago. It was, 10 years after the incident. And they found out that Universal had really suppressed this because they were saying they understood that this was a major loss, but they didn't want other people to really, point the finger at them or
negligence.
Hold them responsible for this loss. But their point was, the truth of it, I'm not sure, but the point was like, look, all the relevant information in these tapes has been digitized and backed up somewhere, right? So there's no loss. The information's there. It's like if Chris had built up a you know, an entire file cabinet of the negatives of the shots that he took, and then it burned, you know, and those negatives are gone, but you know, well, hey, no loss because I've digitized them, I've scanned them, and you know, there's no loss. But I think, and this was something that, this is the part that of the article that I was really kind of really picking up on was, you know, it's not really just about the information, right? It's not really just about the image. It's this, it's the fact that the tape or the negative is a physical artifact from of that event. So right, that tape was in the room.
Think about like if your grandparents' wedding album got burned. Like,
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, the fact that I digitized that album doesn't really, you know, really fix the loss, because those that album is a physical relic that has gives me a direct physical connection of sorts to that original. Mm-hmm. And I think the once everything gets digitized, I think, you know, and they say this is a kind of a cliche, but they say you know, the internet eliminates distance, and I think that's true. But it doesn't make everything closer. It just eliminates the concept of distance. And so we get this weird vertigo sense where we're like, I think when we're swimming in a digital world, everything from the very get-go is digitized. I can't really put myself in any sort of direct physical relation to the original, because there's no, first of all, I don't know what the origin point is. Like, you know, what is the origin? What, like, you know, when it comes to a shot that Chris took, the origin point, the 0-0 point, is the negative. It's the piece of square that the light, that the image from the light, that the light from the image, sorry, first impacted onto this piece of plastic. It was there in the room. Mm-hmm. And the distance between me as someone that wasn't there in that moment is my physical distance or my relationship to that negative. And maybe it's I'm one print removed away from it, you know? But it the event lives on in a way in that relic. And if that relic's gone, then I don't have any physical connection to that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think with digital, there's no origin point. Where's the original? There's no concept of original. And I can't even place myself in relation to, say, the first copy of that, because there's no degradation. So every copy is the same as every other copy. And so people just, you know, you're getting a lot of information about these events. Like when you see photos in online, like in the newspaper or whatever, I mean, they're super high resolution. The colors are, you know, absolutely perfect and I can see everything. But I don't know. Like, I don't know if what I'm trying to say is coming across very well, but it's like,
it feels robotic and cold.
It feels,
put it in everyday non-behavioral. To put it in everyday behavioral terms, I have a lot of photos I took on my phone. I have like lots of folders. I almost never look at them. I do look a lot at my film photos, even though they're all like they've been digitized themselves and they're on my computer. There's something about it because I can often remember the exact moment I took them because it was very deliberate. There was, as I said, a cost to it. And I look at them again and again. I really cherish them. Whereas I have folders of like hundreds of digital photos I took, mostly on my phone. And I'm just like, sometimes I look at them like, oh, I totally forgot I took this. I like, where, when was this again? It was just, you know, stuff like
that. Yeah, there's a detachment to it that's kind of inherent to the medium because for one thing, it's not a very direct, it's not a very direct, there is no connection to tangible reality, right? Like to take the case of photographs here, like this has had serious impacts and will continue to have serious repercussions for us as a society here going forward, especially now that AI is all up in the mix on this. Doctored photographs, right? Once it's digitized, it's endlessly, you know, like you can tweak it endlessly, right? And I think I've noticed that like even professional photographers, like they deprioritize the actual craft of photography, knowing that a lot of stuff can be fixed in post. I won't speak over the photographers in the room, but like that's kind of just like I've been following some photographers for a very long time, and I've kind of noticed that, especially on the rare occasions when they post like a before and after shot. Like the before is garbage sometimes. And then they really just became really good at like commercial photo editing.
They shoot for the edit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, like, it enables them as professionals to create work faster, I guess, and then just rely on fixing it to kind of recreate the vision that they had in their head. So at no point would I say that it's not art, right? Because they are using their own taste, their own creative skill to like manifest an image. But there's no way to say that that final image was exactly what this person saw at the moment that that photo was taken. This has repercussions for people, especially when you're trying to like, when you need to do forensics on this, right? When this photo has repercussions for someone, like in a crime case or a libel case or something, right? Film means like God forbid, Chris, but like let's say a picture gets someone into trouble or something, and you are directly accused of like manipulating it or something. You can whip out the original and say, no, like this was the original. Anything past that had nothing to do with the picture that I actually took.
But also what I'm getting at is that it's not just that. I mean, Chris is saying that he looks at it more because, you know, there was more of a cost to it, right? But I would think that like, the same would be true. It doesn't really, to me, I don't think it really matters so much like what the cost of film is or what the cost of
I don't mean price. I mean more like the fact that I used up something of limited
the physical limitations of that medium mean that Chris had to invest more of himself into the taking of this shot than
live in a world where we didn't think much about taking photographs because, you know, we were awash in cheap film and 1 hour processing, right? It wasn't special like in the 90s.
Man, this is some like back in grandma's day. You'll never guess.
No,
what
but
we
I
had.
Remember when you could go to Costco and just drop off your film, and you know you'd pick up like loads of prints, and nobody gave a shit about this, right?
But we were wealthy. That was
we
wealth.
Lost it. Yeah, we've lost that. And well, here's my point: is that
we had it so good and we trashed it.
We had it so good, though. Everyone was using cheap point and shoots, and they, you know, like people weren't using these nice SLRs like they were in the, you know, like they were. Just,
I actually prefer the way the cheap point shoots look.
The cheap point shoots, yeah.
I mean, compared to the digital cameras or the SLRs?
No, like I will still buy a disposable camera and bring it on vacation with me and take pictures with it. And then when we get the pictures back, we're just like, God, they look so much better still. And it's like, this is a disposable camera.
But so I think 4K is a human rights violation. Like no one should be seen in 4K.
HDR, that garbage.
No.
Well, no, but here's the thing. Like the camera that you guys bought me, it uses medium format film, and the image quality on it is far better than anything I can get out of like say a Pixel 6 or 7. Like the image is super good. So you've got fidelity, you've got image quality, but that's not really what is to me personally. And I suspect that this is in play if subliminally or subconsciously maybe, but I do think that this is in play. The reason, and I agree with Chris, I tend to look at my film photos, of which I'm only have a few right now, but I look at them a lot more. And there's one shot in particular that I took of my wife and my in-laws while we were on vacation is because like, I know when I'm looking at the scan of this photo that I'm really looking at a piece of film that I remember that piece of film being loaded. I remember pressing the shutter. I know at that moment in my head that that moment in time, I know exactly what happened. And that piece of film was the thing that was facing that event, you know, and all the feelings that was going on at the time. And I'm looking at a relic or like an artifact that was created at that very moment. Like it was there with me. Mm-hmm. And you just can't get that sort of like, there's just something very, it just kind of draws my attention. I'm very like fixated on that picture because it's not the digital image itself, but it's that I'm looking at a scan of, I know the removal between me and that moment. And I know how it works because I'm looking at this like scan of a negative, and that negative was the actual film that was in the camera at that point.
And not just that, but I'm sure at the back of your mind, there was the threat of failure. You might have chosen the wrong settings. It could have been washed out or underexposed or something. And then when you get it back, you realize,
yeah, everything went right.
I did something right. As opposed to a digital thing where you can just, you know, chimp out, where you just like, you just take a billion, you know, you could bracket a billion shots or whatever. So there is a sense of accomplishment that I think a lot of people these days lack, because, you know, everything's just hand fed to us.
I'm trying to push this in a direction to say that, yes, that's all true. Like, everyone, there is definitely all this thing about slowing down, trying to getting things right, not being able to instantly correct mistakes. Or in the case of phones now, I think they call it computational photography, where the image is actually altered as you're taking it, right? There's no post, there's no concept of post anymore. All the color correction is done instantaneously, and they'll even defocus, you know, the background. And they'll sharpen the face.
Yeah, like nighttime photography. It's not photography. It's entirely software. It's nothing. Yeah. It's nothing revolutionary about the lens or the sensors involved. It's just that the
algorithms.
The software that renders that image just got very sophisticated, recognizing this is a nighttime photo. This is a line. Should probably sharpen that line.
Yeah, and also there's no longer like this shutter mechanism in the camera where it's like click, that's it, that's the moment. It's keeping the sensor live and the aperture open the entire time,
as long as possible,
it's actually taking a video and then building a picture out of the video that it recorded, right? So it's a totally different thing that's going on, and we don't know, like we have no idea what's going on. We're just like,
guys remember like the big maybe it was just in some photography circles, but like photography competitions and stuff being like, especially in the first days of like Photoshop, being really, really concerned about rooting out like doctored images, altered images. Yes. There was a huge like philosophical debate about how much editing is too much editing. Definitely raged for a long time. That has completely died down, because given how we render digital images now, you can't actually, like before, you could actually do some forensics to tell if an image was doctored. You can't anymore, entirely because of how we render digital images now. So there is no way for anyone, a human or a machine, to be able to tell, just looking at the pixels, whether the thing has been, quote, edited, because it's basically been edited from jump. There is no such thing as like classical photography when we come to digital images anymore.
But compare that to, I think the easiest way to, maybe the better way for me to explain this is like, just forget about, you know, like what we do as regular people, but think about like the great art of the world. And there's always a concept of an original, right? Like we see, you know, a million images of, you know, David, but it's a totally different thing to stand in front of the David, you know, in Florence and see the thing. Not even because it's so great, but because like that's the actual piece of marble.
That's the one that the artist touched.
Exactly. I'm standing. The only thing separating me from Michelangelo or whatever artist, you know, we're talking
it's like
about
10 feet of space.
Yes, exactly. And time.
Right.
You know, but physical distance now has been eliminated between me and this artist. We're looking at the same block, literally the same molecules that
he touched that.
His eye ran over those curves.
Yeah.
And it's weird. Yeah. You know, it feels like being starstruck when you see a really famous painting. Like I went to go see Starry Night not long ago at MoMA, and it's so bizarre. I'm like, this image is everywhere all over the world. It's been printed on placemats, and yet here it is.
It's artwork that people will get on a plane to go see.
Yeah.
No.
And it's like this, there's no better print. There's no better reproduction. Like this is it, but it's not. Look, here's a weird thing is like standing in front of it. Like
it's a different painting.
Underwhelming.
You thought you knew about it. Yeah.
It's smaller than I thought. And it's not, I can't actually see as many details in it as some of the insanely like beautiful, you know, well done scans and prints and stuff where they've really brought out detail. You know, standing there in front of it may not be the best experience of this image that you could possibly get, but it is the spiritual aspect of like, oh shit, that's Van Gogh's, like that's his brushstroke. You know, like there's a piece of canvas there, like he stretched that canvas. he bought this thing, this canvas. He, this is it. This is the thing that came from him. And so there's always in art, clearly, you know, an understanding that the original, there's a something very special about being in front of it. Mm-hmm. That cannot, no matter how good a reproduction we can make, and we can make, I think, better than perfect reproductions when it comes to, like, say, paintings, because the painting itself often looks kind of old and dirty, and they have these really great ways of scanning and photographing these things that look even better than the real thing. So it's not even the best, you know, experience insofar as just looking at the picture, but I do think it's just this communion where you're like, I feel close to these great artists in a real sense. It's almost like you're standing in front of the artist. And
yeah, the proof of what you're saying, we can see it in music, actually. Sorry to cut you off, but just something occurred to me. So Spotify gutted, you know, music distribution and sales and all of that, right? Like artists get paid nothing based on like digital, like sales or like streaming services. So like concerts, touring has become like the biggest moneymaker for them, for all big names. Like I think I read the touring is how most artists actually make the bulk of their earnings. Digital sales and like royalties from streaming is like entirely secondary. And it's if it were true that there is no value lost, right? It's like a digital recording is just the same thing as being there in person. People wouldn't be paying like obscene amounts of money to go see these people in concert. So the emotional truth of what we're saying is kind of evident. Maybe not so much in like visual art yet, maybe, but like look at music. Like people pay like top dollar to go see like Adele or, you know, whoever your favorite
and
stars
are. And let's face
it,
they're not going to sound as good live as they do on these, like, you know, the CDs or whatever that they put out, these streams that they put out, because those are totally, you know, their best take. And, you know, everything's error corrected and pitch corrected. They sound perfect. And then you go watch them in concert. And honestly, they don't sound as good, but it's still a much better experience.
Still,
it's a different experience.
You.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To be close to them.
Because you're seeing something real.
And to be, even seeing the imperfection is part of the allure there. Despite like a more perfect rendition of that same piece of music, you have access to an infinite number of copies of that. You can listen to it as many times as you care to. But chances are, if you want somebody who does want to listen to that recording that much, also would pay top dollar to go see them in concert. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I don't want to abandon like imagery and stuff, but I also want to introduce typewriters before you know, this episode ends. Because I think that I'm biased because I have more of a writer mindset than like a visual artist mindset. But I think typewriters are even more extreme in that it totally changes the way you express yourself, because I mean, what's its counterpart these days is your computer or your laptop. And, you know, as different as digital cameras are, or I guess maybe phones might be the equivalent, but, you know, a digital camera, you can't like go on social media on your digital camera, at least not yet. But, you know, your laptop really is your portal to the entire digital world. Whereas a typewriter, you can only do one thing on it. You can only write. And we see a lot of writers or wannabe writers always complaining about, you know, distractions and stuff. Like, no, you get a typewriter. It's the only thing you can do. You can look at it, but there's only one way and you can only go forward. Maybe you can white out a few words or there, but you cannot jump around. And I mean, Teen, you recently had that experience in which, yeah, you just got a typewriter and you wrote a short story, which I read and I really enjoyed. And I hope you do more of it. And I think getting a typewriter really helped, right?
Yeah, I think because I was thinking about this, like I've never written anything of that length in that short amount of time. And it was like, when I got the typewriter, I was just like, I just couldn't stop typing on the damn thing. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the reasons is because I noticed that like you're just forced to commit, right? So the first word that you pick to start a sentence, like you're stuck with that word more or less. I mean, I guess you could go and white it out, but it, you know, what are you going to do? Every sentence you're going to do that. So you develop this sense of like, if I pick the first word, I'm stuck with it. and I got to make the best out of that sentence. And then you start realizing that like the quality of a sentence is not determined until you finish the sentence. So,
or you're in a paragraph or the entire story. It's like,
yeah, exactly. It keeps going.
To the end of a line too, when you hear the ding.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
It is a very rhythmic feeling of being on the typewriter. That ding comes periodically, and then the clack of each key comes. And you know what it feels like, Liza? It feels like talking.
Yeah.
You know, talking is very rhythmic, and I can't delete something that I've said. It just, mm-hmm. I just have to commit. Every word that comes out of my mouth, I can't go back and take it back. And I don't know how the sentence, sometimes I don't know how the sentence is going to finish, but I just say it anyway. And the problem with writing on a computer is you keep trying to aim for perfection.
Because you can just delete anytime you want and then rewrite it, it allows you to just clear your throat like a million times.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And it just have that spontaneity. And I always felt that every time I was writing something on a computer, it just was felt dead compared to if I was just talking to a friend and telling them a story. And the typewriter
at the house, really, it was my dad's old one. And now it's basically just decoration in the study now because I'm afraid to use it.
It probably still works. These things are tough machines.
Yes. Yeah, but first of all, Teen, it's going to break.
First of all, Teen, what's your typewriter? What kind do you have?
It's an Italian. So it's an Italian typewriter called the Olivetti Litera. And
32, right? Litera 32.
32, yeah. And I got it real custom machine. From Italy.
Yeah. Yeah, like that's a real good machine.
It's really cool. It's not great for English because it doesn't have a lot of English of the regular English character special characters, like no dollar sign and no asterisk. And it wasn't QWERTY. They had to the person in Italy I bought it from had to switch some of the keys around, which is another thing that you can do. You can tweak these things, you know. Like I couldn't, only you could do that with a computer.
Who needs a letter E? Yeah. But that's another thing. When I got the typewriter, so I'm a pretty fast typist on a computer, and I realized if you try doing that on a typewriter, it'll jam. All the keys will strike at once, and you got to pull it back. So it's like, okay, you got to slow down, and you got to hit with quite a bit of force. It can't be like these MacBooks I have, they got a butterfly keyboard, you barely have to touch it. It's almost like touchscreen. You got to commit, and it's like that is symbolic of what you were saying. It's like, no, you got to go all out. And it reminded me, you guys remember that old movie Galaxy Quest where this they had that device where you could reverse time by like 13 seconds. So anytime you made a mistake, you'll be like, oops, and then you just go back in time. And I know we all wish we had that device, but in reality, if we had it, it would make life a lot less interesting because anytime you fucked up, you'd be like, okay, do over. But a typewriter is like, no, you got to live with your consequences, at least for that day, writing wise. Okay, you started off with a cheesy sentence. Make the best of it. Let's see what you can do next day.
Maybe
you can improve it. And
that's exactly what it is. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And when I first started, writing, actually trying to write, it that fear is always, I got to make everything perfect and whatever. And what got me over that, and this was even on a computer, was just, no, you know what? First draft, who cares? Just get it out there and then build from it. You just need a foundation. You don't need to be perfect. In fact, it shouldn't be perfect. Have fun. Be corny. Be cliche, whatever. You can improve it later. Nobody's first draft is good. And I think a typewriter is even more exemplary of that.
Yeah, I noticed that I would write myself into a little bit of a corner on the typewriter because I'm like, oh shit, I can't go back now. And then you've got to, but then you get creative because you're like, wait, well, how do I write myself out of this? Or like, how do I progress it? Even, and I spent very little time, I didn't crumple any papers and throw it out. I was just like, fuck it. I'll just, just keep going, And I don't know. It was just such a fun experience because it has the same spontaneity as talking with someone where, again, there's no redo button, in life when you're talking with someone, us doing this pod, which I think maybe one of the reasons why it's been so many years and we're still doing pods is because maybe there's some analog type element to doing something like this rather than just writing stuff, especially digitally, because we never take stuff back. We never do oh shit, hold on. Let me delete that. Let me start over. We're just we have no idea how this thing is going to go before we start. I have no idea where we're going to go with it.
I have murdered some sentences on this pod, let me tell you. Holy shit. The level of not conjugating the right verb.
Remember how I pronounced the director of Dune? Chris?
Oh, yeah.
And we Villanueva, kept that whole thing in there.
Villanueva.
Villanueva. Which I still say.
Like, I was like clapping, listening. Like, yeah, you go, girl. Yeah, you put that there. I didn't know how to pronounce that shit either. Yeah. You, you really put yourself out there. But yeah, probably. I mean, have you guys ever gone to like exhibits of like old writers, and there's like a like an exhibit of their papers and their drafts for display?
It's so messy.
It's so
I've
messy.
Seen some of like really Charles cool. Dickens stuff, and it's like, mm-hmm. how did this ever turn into a book? This is just this is crazy. Or yeah, like you look chaotic. At the Constitution. Like, you look at the Constitution, the you're like, how did anyone read yeah. this fucking thing?
Like, yeah. The biggest finished novel is like 700 pages. So, God damn it, how many drafts?
He was handwriting that whole thing.
Like, I think
you wrote that with a feather? What?
The chickens just ran every time they see you come through.
Like, yeah, like, whoa. Dude,
kill
bro.
More chickens than Colonel Sanders.
But like I had a long afternoon to kill. So I just I think it was I don't know, I think it was who was it? Mark Twain. Now that this guy knew how to this guy was I mean he's a prolific writer, but then his papers were on display, and obviously like it's not even a typewriter, it's just like writing on a piece of paper, right? It was kind of cool to just look at a like page that he wrote. And then mm-hmm. like seeing like the things he crossed out and then like notes he made in the margin or like, mm-hmm. you know, him moving words around or shifting a sentence or a paragraph. It's kind of cool to see, like, you can kind of trace like where his head was at. So it's not even yeah. just like the page itself that you're valuing. Mm-hmm. At that yeah. point, you get to kind of get a peek into what was going through his actual head in putting this particular like passage together or something. And like that actually added a little bit of meaning. I think I was looking at a page of like Huckleberry Finn, and he reworked it so it was a little bit more like emotionally poignant for Huckleberry to be going through. Like it was like part of his whole like, yeah, he was on his raft and he was just going through something, and it just added a little bit extra like pathos to it. Mm-hmm. So you can see like what he originally wrote, and then you can see like in the margins where he wrote like what he actually wanted. Like he like, okay, no, this is what I'm gonna do when I rewrite this in my next draft. It was kind of cool to see, like, that's an entire kind of layer of meaning to a work that we're completely losing at you know, just passing around like Google Docs to each other, basically. Yeah. Like, what are you gonna do, just look at track changes?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but was Huckleberry Finn the book where Mark Twain basically almost finished and realized that he messed up and he went back and rewrote the whole thing? I know it was a Mark Twain book, I think. But yeah,
was just known for.
Right. And yeah, and as a friend of mine, I mean, this is related. A friend of mine sent me this article. I think it was written a couple of years ago, but it was an article that was highly critical of Sally Rooney, the writer, and how her, not her just specifically, but you know, that a lot of her type, their whole shtick is, oh, you know, me, I'm no genius. I just like published this, you know, ultra popular, critically acclaimed thing or made this thing or whatever. And it just came so naturally to me. And then the writer contrasted that with an essay that Rooney had wrote years earlier when she was not a famous writer, talking about how she was actually the debate champ of either Ireland or Europe or something like that. And in it, she was just like saying, no, I want to be the best. And I tried really hard and all that. But then I guess when she became more famous, it wasn't fashionable to be a tryhard. And that one thing that this whole digitized thing is, it lets you cover up your footsteps, you know, all the, you know, words you crossed out,
right.
All the mm-hmm. all the drafts that you say, you know, oh, me? Oh, my first draft, you know, this is this silly little thing. You know, it's that garbage.
I think the problem is it's a sense of commitment, because it's like when you're using some kind of physical medium to write, be it handwriting or typewriting, typing it out. I guess those are the mm-hmm. two options, right? You're making like, you're making some sort of physical change in the world at you know, on a piece of paper or whatever, but it is like being fixed as you're going. Whereas with typing, you know, what do you, you're not really doing, you're literally just maybe moving around some electrons, and those can be infinitely shuffled around. It's kind of like clicking, you know, clicking the beads on an abacus up and down, right? Like, yeah, you're doing something physical, but it's like very unfixed. Like, none of it's fixed. All of it's meant to be temporary.
The value of that click is is zero.
Right. Yeah. And the commitment of it is zero. It's all meant to be infinitely, undoable.
And that's not a ding, actually. I mean, this is exactly what the digital quote revolution and what the internet was for. Totally, it's supposed to be a seamless pipeline. Where we run into trouble is trying to place some artificial corrals around this information.
Mm-hmm.
And then trying to lend a value system to it. Like, it's remarkable, and it's extremely successful at the exact thing that it was supposed to do, which is simply allow people to transmit information from one place to another. Right. That's an amazing accomplishment. I mean, this is how I am talking to you guys a continent away in real time. Right. So that same thing that brought us that is also like basically lowered the barrier of entry of producing data, producing information down to zero.
Mm-hmm. Which is good. Which is good.
It's good. But, I mean, it's good in its own way and for its own purpose.
But have you noticed that, like, and I saw this, there was a commercial for I don't know, some like new fucking laptop that is crazy. It's got like, I don't know, some laptop, right? It's like some hot new laptop. And there's a commercial for it where, and you see this a lot with like new tech gadgets where they advertise it as essentially like a creative tool. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, they'll have some famous guy. I think they had like a famous architect sort of demonstrating how he would use this. And, you know, of course, he's, you know, in a coffee shop and like inspiration strikes and he whips out his
Surface Pro 5.
Yeah, Surface Pro. And he like, you know, sketches it out. And then he goes to the office and he can like share that file and distribute it or whatever. And he can hold it up in a meeting. And, you know, and there's this real fetishization of these digital technologies as being enabling just feats of creativity that weren't
possible before. No, it's the opposite.
Before. It is the opposite. Don't you think people are less creative these days? And I think
absolutely.
This idea that,
yes.
You know.
This is the end of part one of this podcast. The second part of the podcast is available on our Patreon feed.